ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Australia's always been the lucky country. Sunshine, beaches, and that one magpie that always seems to know where you live.
Yeah, get away from my chip, please. Luck might not cut it anymore.
So can we make our own luck and turn this complicated world to our advantage?
That's our global roaming summer season. Can Australia surf the world's chaos without wiping out?
Fresh new episodes all summer. Search for Global Roaming on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Every time you download an app, sign up for a service, or even just visit a website, you're agreeing to something. But how do you actually know what you're agreeing to? Hello, you're listening to Download This Show on ABC Radio National. I'm Ray Johnston, and welcome to episode 4 of our special series, Opt Out, the Download This Show guide to taking back control of your online life. In this series, I'm taking you on my own personal journey towards a full internet opt-out, from finding out how much of my highly personal info is out there, to figuring out how to scrub it from existence and lock it all down so it doesn't happen again. And episode 4 is all about reading the fine print, or rather, not reading it, because let's be honest, none of us are. Think about the last time you hit accept on a terms and conditions agreement or a privacy policy. Did you read it? All of it? If you didn't, you're not alone. It would take more than 6 working weeks a year to read every privacy policy or terms of service you encounter. And even if you had the time, would you even understand what you were reading? Words like pseudonymized data and hashed email addresses aren't exactly plain English. While we're all clicking accept without reading, companies like Google, Meta, and Spotify, even our cars, are collecting extraordinary amounts of data about us. And they're using language in those terms and conditions that makes it impossible for us to understand what we're really agreeing to. I spoke with Dr. Catherine Kemp, someone who does understand. She's an associate professor at the University of New South Wales, who specialises in privacy law and consumer protection. There are a lot of services out there that we expect or assume will have our data. You know, places where we've put it ourselves, like social media or online shopping. But you've done research on a few others. Could you tell us a little bit about the more surprising places that our data is being harvested?
I think one of the developing areas for Australia is that when it comes to the cars that we drive, increasingly cars are connected in the sense that they have embedded internet connectivity through a SIM card that's in the car itself. And one of the things that this means, as we've been examining in our research on privacy in connected cars, is that you constantly in real time have information about you and your activities going back to the manufacturer and other third parties, as well as various remote control functions that are associated with that car. Now, the way that this is described or sometimes not described in the fine print for when you're purchasing a car may not make obvious the kinds of things that are revealed about you as you're using a connected car. Even if you think about your location history on that car, you know, the map of where you move throughout the day and throughout the week, that can go to revelations about whether you have children, the age of your children, when you know, what your routine is, whether you visit certain medical practices and experts, whether you visit family law practitioners and so forth. So there's a great deal that comes through in something that sounds as harmless as location data, and that in many of these cases is being used beyond safety and for things like marketing and profiling of users.
I know it only took a couple of weeks for me in my car for it to work out where home was. I never told it where home was, but I'm assuming, based on the fact that I'm going there every day and that's where the car is staying, that my car just went, oh, well, this must be home. And now whenever I get in the car and I'm not home, it's saying, do you want to head here? It's home. It felt a little bit intrusive.
There are so many inferences that are like that, that one is a fairly obvious one in the sense of where you leave from in the morning, when you come back at night, that's where you go to, that must be home. But there are more inferences that can be less obvious in terms of where your workplace is, where your kids go to school based on time of day and so forth, but also what your interests are, what your ethnic background is, that can come through in things like, you know, what are the choices on the entertainment system that you're selecting? What are you searching for in terms of places that you're visiting? What's your place of worship? Therefore, what is your religion? That wouldn't immediately spring to mind for a lot of car owners as things that their car is collecting and able to be used by car manufacturers for other purposes.
That's fascinating. I never even considered that. Now, we've had conversations in this series about consent and consent needing to be informed, not coerced. Legally, how meaningful is the consent that users give when they click accept?
Well, this is both a practical and a legal question. On the legal side, under our Privacy Act, we've got pretty lame definitions for consent at present because it includes not only express consent, but implied consent, so to speak. So a lot of companies are taking advantage of that in believing or alleging that they have consent on the basis that they have a privacy policy available somewhere via a link, and the existence of that policy available somewhere means that you must have consented to that if you're using the service. So it can be a situation where it's quite unlikely that a user, especially if they're engaged in a certain activity or just downloading an app, will have had access to those terms, and yet they're essentially assuming you must know all of the things that we listed there, understand them, understand the consequences of our repurposing of that data and our collection of data from extra third parties, and therefore you've consented. On a practical basis, we also need to think about how feasible is it for the average person to understand the terminology that is used in those policies that in many ways seems to be designed not to be understood.
How are Australia's legal standards on this? Are they weaker than other parts of the world, stronger? Where do we stand globally?
We're certainly well below the gold standard of privacy protections that exist in the EU. And now I say gold standard because that's really as good as we've got so far globally, but there's even room for improvement in Europe. But in Australia, we, for example, have a narrower definition of what personal information is. That sounds boring, but it matters because that is the scope of what is covered by the whole privacy law. So if the company is alleging this is not even personal information when it is really linked to you, they're treating it as if they've got no privacy obligations in that respect at all, as well as the EU having higher standards for consent, requiring it to be express and unambiguous and requiring action on the part of the individual to give their consent, and that it's unbundled so that you can't combine all these purposes together and say you consented to all of these purposes because you agreed to take on this service.
So when you've got organisations saying this isn't personal information, we don't deem this personal information, what kind of information are they talking about?
It's really interesting because the technology in this respect has changed a lot over the years, so that nowadays a company doesn't need your email address, your phone number, your name to track you and to deliver certain messages to you, get you to act in certain ways, essentially target you as an individual. All of that can be done without those traditional identifiers. So a big way that companies, including data brokers and advertising technology companies and digital platforms, social media platforms, share information about you is by using what they sometimes call pseudonymized information, or they might refer to these as information that doesn't directly identify you, or hashed email addresses. Now, the idea is that instead of using your full name or your email address, they put that information through something called hash function. It's essentially a formula. It spits out a string of numbers and letters that's unique then to you or the user of your mobile phone, if you were to put it that way. And then they can use that and between them collect up all the information they respectively have on you and create this big sort of dossier on you to give that 360-degree view of your life. And for most of these companies, they're saying, that's not personal information. We didn't use your name and email address. We first put it through this hash function, and therefore we're not dealing with data that's covered by the Privacy Act. That is a gaping hole for us in the protection of our personal information.
That's just extraordinary. So it's anonymized in a sense, but it's also not in another way entirely.
Well, the use of the word anonymized is fairly problematic for us in Australia because it's bandied about by companies too. Like, a lot of people would think anonymized means you take your name off it. In the EU, anonymized means it cannot be linked back to you as an individual. That's impossible. So it's a term that's not defined in Australia, but merely taking your name or email address, contact details off the file on you does not mean that information can't be linked back to you. Companies are constantly finding other ways to link that back to you.
This is incredible. I'm learning so much from you. Thank you. Now, back to terms and conditions. You know, from a legal perspective, what are the key structural failures in the way that terms and conditions are offered and enforced?
There's so much in this. It's hard to know where to start. Something fundamental is the whole notice and consent approach to our privacy law, which has been with us since the 1980s. The idea that individuals can just understand these extensive notices and have the time to do that and consent to them and understand the full consequences of this is problematic in itself, because the research has been done that it would take you more than 6 working weeks a year to do that. So anytime people start saying, oh, I'm terrible, I don't read all of the privacy terms and so forth, don't say you're terrible. It's impossible for you to do that. And the task has been set in this impossible way. So we need to move away from that notice and consent approach and to be thinking more about substantive fairness. In Australia, some particular concerns for us under the privacy law and the way companies are operating include their ability to repurpose data at the moment and say, I'm using this for a related purpose that I mentioned in the privacy policy. And also the fact that companies are collecting data about us from third parties, including data brokers, when we have an existing law that says that generally they are prohibited from doing that. It's not been enforced in respect of these what's called data enrichment services, but it should be enforced in those circumstances.
There are a lot of digital platforms out there that have take it or leave it kind of terms. You either accept them or you're barred from the platform. You can't use it. So how does consumer law or competition law currently address or even fail to address these kinds of non-negotiable contracts?
It's an interesting question in Australia because our approach to competition law is different to jurisdictions like Europe, where in Europe they have a concept of what is called exploitative abuse. So what this has meant is, for example, in Germany, you have the competition regulator, the Bundeskartellamt, has taken Meta, for instance, to court for abuse of dominance, for imposing terms like that on consumers and insisting on consumers consenting to the connecting up of their information across various Meta services. And they were able to do that, as in a similar way to if a company charged prices that were too high, these are considered to be exploitative terms and therefore you can succeed under the German competition law. You can't do that in Australia. We don't have a concept of exploitative abuse. We have misuse of market power, which focuses on whether the firm is able to exclude other rivals from the market. And it's that suppression of rivalry that is the focus. So the assumption in Australia is that if a dominant firm is doing something exploitative, then other players will enter the market and offer something better, and consumers will go to that other service. A big problem is consumers, in the context of privacy, don't understand how bad it is. And, you know, secondly, there tends to be a race to the bottom in terms of companies both hiding what they're doing with data and not competing on privacy terms.
On a more optimistic note, where do you see positive or promising legal developments? What gives you hope?
I see some small signs of hope. I must say that working in this area, a lot of the time you just feel like you're swimming upstream and is it worth going on in light of the push from the other side? But that when you start to see regulators, policymakers being prepared to look to the fundamentals of our law in this area and say, is consent broken because of that imbalance in power and information? Is it time that we take, as experts, as government, take more control over these data practices so that we're recognising what we're talking about here is a human right? There is a human right to privacy, and it shouldn't just be up for grabs on the basis that a company can essentially trick an individual into some kind of fictional consent. And that is, that human right is also something that is an important benefit for the whole of our society. It goes to questions of how well does our democracy function, including if you are able as companies, as political profiling companies, to create these highly detailed profiles that allow you to do micro-targeting in political messaging that affects the outcomes of elections. This goes far beyond what are your individual concerns and impacts, even though those are great as well.
That was Dr. Catherine Kemp from the University of New South Wales Law and Justice, explaining the legal mess behind those terms and conditions we never read. You are listening to Download This Show on ABC Radio National. I'm Ray Johnston. And like Catherine says, our consent isn't really consent at all. Legally, companies in Australia can claim you've consented just because their privacy policy exists somewhere via a link, even if you've never seen it. They're calling this implied consent, and it's allowing them to do things with your data that you'd never knowingly agree to. But the legal side is only part of the story, because even when we try to opt out, even when we want to make different choices, the systems we rely on every day don't give us real alternatives. To tell us more, here's Dr. Skye Crosser, a senior lecturer at Curtin University who researches how people try to gain control over the technologies in their everyday lives.
Now, how often are we, as consumers, agreeing to or accepting terms, conditions, cookies, privacy policies that we don't actually understand? It feels like we're doing it every day.
We are doing it every day. And it's not just when you first join a platform like Facebook or TikTok. It's also when they update their terms and conditions, which happen quite frequently. It's also when you revisit websites. It's also when you're logged into Facebook and browsing the web and Facebook is still capturing your data. It's happening across all kinds of different spaces in our leisure time, in our work time, all through the day.
I think specifically also about instances where you'll receive an email from a company and they'll say, we've updated our terms and conditions, but they don't actually specify which terms and conditions have been updated. And in order to see the difference, you would have to read both sets, which can be enormous. How do you feel about that?
Well, I think that we have a tendency sometimes to blame people for not taking the time to read the terms and conditions, but we don't have time to read them all, and we don't always have the skills to understand exactly what those terms and conditions mean. And I think that companies rely on that. For a while, there was a push, and I think there are still some advocacy organizations pushing for what they call human-readable terms and conditions
that make it
easier for people to understand exactly what they're agreeing to.
So when digital platforms are saying that we consent to data collection, with all of this in context, how meaningful is that consent in practice?
Well, let's go back and think about what consent really means. Usually you want meaningful consent to be informed, so for people to actually understand what they're agreeing to, and also not coerced. If somebody is saying, well, you have to do this or you'll face some kind of serious consequences, that's not meaningful consent, is it? But the fact is that if we say that we don't consent, then that will have really serious consequences for many of us in terms of our social lives, in terms of our work lives, in terms of our ability to stay in touch with family, even things like checking in and out of daycare with my kid. I now have to use an app to do that. So that consent isn't properly informed, and it's also in many ways coerced. We often don't have meaningful alternatives to giving consent to using these services.
So when the fine print is just too complex for most people to understand, is it ethical for companies to treat our acceptance as agreement?
It's not ethical. And I think that the business model of most of these companies is built on the understanding that we don't have a meaningful alternative to agreeing. Mm. I think that one of the reasons why people often don't read the terms and conditions is because they know it doesn't really matter. They're not going to say, I won't install that app that I need to get my job done. They're not going to say, I'm not going to have Facebook because that means I'll no longer have contact with friends and family or get invited to local community events. And so why read the terms and conditions if you don't really have an option but to agree to them if you want to use that platform? So building an entire business model around that doesn't seem particularly ethical, no.
Through your research, what are you finding people say they want from digital platforms in terms of transparency, control, fairness even?
For example, use technology that is not going to completely and utterly undermine their data. People want to have choices about what the algorithms that show them different content prioritize. People want to be able, for example, to see posts and material that come from friends or small local businesses rather than whatever makes the most money for social media companies. And people also want to be able to have access to technology companies that are not actively making the world worse, participating in genocide, doing all kinds of terrible things that a lot of these big tech companies that we use every day are doing.
That sounds wonderful. Do you think it could ever happen, though?
It is happening. That's the really exciting part.
Tell me more.
There are already parts of the internet that are run by communities for communities. I'm thinking of, for example, Mastodon, which is this great social media alternative that doesn't require people to give away their data. It doesn't require them to then be locked into a network where if they leave, they'll lose all of their connections. It's run usually by volunteers. It's run by people who are self-funding their little communities. And if you don't like the space you're in on Mastodon, you can move to another space and take your connections with you. And most of the time, there's no advertising apart from, people who might be talking about their music or their art. There's no algorithms. It's just a really lovely space where people aren't trying to make money for a big corporation. They're just trying to build connections and community because they love it and they care about it and they want to see a version of the internet that works like that.
It feels like we're currently just in this inescapable mess that is being created by people that don't have our best interests at heart. And I know, even myself as a tech journalist of 15 years, I feel overwhelmed by all of the tech jargon, endless pop-ups, you know, just everything that's happening online. It feels like there's a huge power dynamic at play here. And I'd love to hear from you, for me and for the listeners as well, for anyone who's feeling overwhelmed by this, you know, what should we understand about the power dynamics behind all of this?
Firstly, I think it's really important that we don't blame ourselves for not understanding or not making the right choices. Huge amounts of money is being made from all of these big platforms. And the companies that are making that money are then putting that money back into pushing technologies that they think will not just make them more money, but also help them achieve their political goals, which are not necessarily the same goals that you or I might hold dear. Yeah. But then the next thing to think is, well, every time we spent our time and our attention and share our data with these big tech platforms, we are giving them a little of ourselves and our energy. And looking for ways to decrease that, looking for ways to shift over to alternatives that are better for our community, that still allow us to enjoy the internet, that still allow us to make the most of the tremendous possibility that exists in this network of networks, is great. And you don't have to do it all. You can start small. Just find something that feels replaceable for you and work on replacing that.
That was Dr. Skye Crosser from Curtin University. And I have to say, talking with Skye gave me something I didn't expect in a conversation about privacy law: optimism. Because while the systems we're stuck in right now are exploitative and overwhelming, there are alternatives. Communities building better versions of the internet. Platforms that Skye brought up, like Mastodon, where people connect without handing over their data to corporations. Little pockets of the internet that still work the way it used to, run by people who care about helping each other out online. But here's what you need to understand after these conversations. Firstly, those terms and conditions you're accepting, you're not terrible for not reading them. It's literally impossible. And the companies know this. They're counting on it. So what can you actually do? Catherine recommends going into your app settings and auditing what you've given permission to. Look at what data each app is collecting and turn off everything you absolutely don't need to give them. Plus, use privacy-friendly alternatives where you can. Skye mentioned Mastodon as a social media alternative that doesn't harvest your data, and DuckDuckGo or Brave for browsing instead of things like Chrome. Next time on Download This Show's special series, Opt Out, after weeks of trying to take back control, I'm asking the ultimate question: can you ever really opt out completely and take back control of your online life? And that's it for episode 4 of Opt Out, the Download This Show guide to taking back control of your online life. You can listen to all the episodes of our special series now on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Rae Johnston, and this has been another episode of Download This Show on ABC Radio National.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.